Yesterday we talked about persecuted faith, and we're going to see that that somewhat continues as you move into chapter 12, as you bring that persecution of old into the persecution of present for these people. And I want to suggest let's move it forward about 2,000 years to our time. And we think about many of us being here full-time evangelists, and we have to counsel people who are working every day out in corporate America and are working in various places. And you think about our work with them as a means of edification. I come back to Ephesians chapter 4, where it says that he gave apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, and teachers for the equipping of the saints for the work of service to the edifying of the body of Christ. I think part of our work is equipping Christians to worship, equipping them for discipleship, equipping them for evangelism. But I tell you what, a facet of all of those and the equipping that we might have to do is equipping them and preparing them for what they have to face in everyday life as a Christian, specifically some of the same struggles that they're dealing with in the book of Hebrews. I bring that up because sometimes when we talk about persecution that might be coming, we think preachers are going to get tagged as people who are giving all this hate speech, and they're the ones that are going to get shut down. I don't think we're going to be the ones that are shut down first. I think it's going to be the people who don't go along with the company line, with the union line, and that's going to make our work equipping them for the work that they're doing, the service that they're showing to God. And I want us to keep that in mind. It may eventually come to us, and if God decides to let it happen to us first, we need to be ready to stand just the same as them. But we do need to be ready to equip Christians for the work that they're going to be doing. What does that look like? It looks like Hebrews encouraging them, saying, these people did it in old times. Jesus did it. We're His followers. Let's walk in this legacy. Let's be faithful. And let's hold them up. When they start losing jobs, we're there. And we're going to hold up the weak hands. We're going to help the prisoners. And we're going to make sure that we all finish this race together. The illustration of a race is teased in Hebrews chapter 11, verses 39 and 40, and then it comes to full in chapter 12. But I'd like us to read chapter 11 before we 39 and 40, before we sing this song that I've asked Colton to lead us in. Hebrews chapter 11, remember it says, "And all these, having gained approval through their faith, did not receive what was promised, because God had provided something better for us, so that apart from us, they would not be made perfect." Now we're going to see some perfection language come into chapter 12. And we're not even going to deal with all the perfection language that comes into chapter 12. But notice this. We need to start in chapter 11 envisioning a great relay race, where all these people who have gone before are passing the baton. I was not a runner up until the last decade or so, maybe a little bit more than that. In fact, I was rather slow and stocky whenever I was younger. However, there was one year that I did track and field, and I was on the throwing team, and so shot put and discus. But we had a home meet, and our regular team was running, relay racers, and of course the opposing teams. And then they decided, since the opposing teams, there was two of those, we were allowed to bring one more team in. So they threw all the throwers in together for that race. And we ran, and we could not even see them in the distance. But I tell you what, I got a ribbon that day. And that's because every other team, even our own good team, was disqualified. They stepped out of bounds. We finished. But when I think about the baton being passed off, that's what I think about. Four stocky, slow guys. We ran, we passed the baton, kept running. We need to see ourselves in a relay race. Abraham passed the baton to his son. To his son, to his son. And now we Gentiles have been able to pick up the baton, and we're running the same race that they did. But ultimately, We're going to be looking to someone far greater in this race. And we're going to talk about that today. We're going to talk about looking to Jesus. And so Colton's going to lead us in the song, My Faith Looks Up to Thee. We sing that song from time to time, and it was looking at that song through the lens of Hebrews 12 that added some new meaning for me. It's not specifically taken from Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, I don't believe, but here is a faith that looks to Jesus, that sees Him as the guide, and that when a weary heart is beginning to get overrun and oppressed, that faith is looking to Jesus. That sounds an awful lot like Romans chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, maybe even include verse 4 as well. He says, I don't want you to grow weary and lose heart. I don't want you to give up on this race. Look to Jesus. Look to Jesus. This afternoon, we're going to look at three major points. Number one, we're going to look at the race that is set before us. Number two, we're going to look at the author and perfecter of our faith. And number three, we're going to look at how Jesus got a crown from a cross, or gave a through a cross to a crown. Let's start first with the race that is set before us. In Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1, again, he's already teased the language of we're still going to finish something together. It says, therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Now note here that we have athletic imagery that is being used. I think every English translation, almost, says, let us run the race. Let us run the race. Now, this imagery is used in other places. For instance, look with me in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 24 through 27. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 24 through 27. Do you not know that all those who run in a race, all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may win. Everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air. But I discipline my body and make it my slave so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified. Literally, he says, all who run in a stadium, they're going to be these who practice self-control. Control. Why? So that they receive the victory crown. So, running in a stadium, literally. Look with me in 2 Timothy chapter 4. 2 Timothy chapter 4. He says in verse number 6, for I am already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure has come. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the course. Literally, I have finished the foot race. I have kept the faith. In the future, there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day, and not only to me, but also to all who have loved His appearing. Now, he's mixing a lot of metaphors here, but one of those is, he ran the foot race, and he's going to receive the crown, the victory crown at the end. Now, of the three passages we're going to be looking at here, of 1 Corinthians 9, 2 Timothy chapter 4, and Hebrews chapter 12, this is the only one that uses the word race. It is translated course here, a foot race. Now let's go over to Hebrews chapter 12. And I'm not saying there's not race imagery here, because he's using a verb, run. And so obviously he's using this imagery, but he uses a more generic term that I think is going to be significant. In Hebrews chapter 12, and again, verse 1, did you see, let us run, so there's our running language, with endurance, the race that is set before us. That word race is the word struggle, contest, fight. We get our English word agony from this word. And so it can mean a race, and it does in this metaphor. It is a race, but isn't it significant? And I don't have much for the Dewey Rhymes 1899 Bible. It's there's things you're going to have problems with as a true Christian. But it says, let us run, maybe compete in the fight. So they recognize that this race is a fight. It's a struggle. We are agonizing toward the finish line, if you will. And this fits well because look at what he says in verse number 4. Hebrews chapter 12 and verse number 4. You have not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood in your striving against sin. That word striving against, one word in the Greek language, and it has the same root. Agonizo, it's actually agonizome, but it has the word anti on the front of it, and so it's a striving against. It's a struggling against. He just said, there's a struggle set before us. How does he define that specifically? You're in a struggle against sin. And so as they are fighting these battles, as they are running this race, he says, you need to look to Jesus because he is the one who has set this struggle before you. Notice that this is a race that is set before us. Now, in the Bible, often when you have a passive verb, or in this case, a passive participle, and I know some of you, you heard grammar and you thought, okay, I'll wait for 30 seconds, and that's fine. You can do that if you want to. But if we look at this passive verb or passive participle, often if it does not have a who did it, so set by whom? We don't know. It doesn't give us the by whom. If it doesn't give you the by whom explicitly, often the implication is God is the one who is over this. Who has set this race before us? Well, we're supposed to fix our eyes on Jesus. Why? Because he's the author and perfecter of faith. He's the one who has run this course. Now, who gave him that struggle? It is the Father's will. And I come to do the Father's will. And he has set this before me. We know that God does not tempt us to do evil. God does not want us to fail. But God does set a struggle before us. And that's what this race is. Granted, he's using these opponents. He's using those who are hostile against God's people. Notice in verse number 3, for consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. Obviously, the struggle is coming because you have the oppression. You have the opponents. But God is saying, this is your struggle to face. You have to run this race. In fact, we know that God is the one who is at least over this and in part behind this because you switch metaphors, but you have the same teaching that is happening when you get to verse number 4. For you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood in your striving against sin, and you have forgotten the exhortation which is addressed to you as sons. My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint when you are reproved by him. For whom the Lord loves, he disciplines, and he scourges every son whom he receives. For it is for discipline that you endure. God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there among whom his father does not discipline? But if you are without discipline, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Furthermore, we had earthly fathers to discipline us, and we respected them. Shall we not much rather be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time as seemed best to them. Becca?
You've gone down in cost of prosperity on the internet.
She waved to me the first time and then waved to me again. All right. But he disciplines us for our good so that we may share his holiness. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. Yet to those who have been trained by it, afterward it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness. Who has set this struggle before us? It is God, our Father, who loves us and says, you will not bear the fruit you need to bear unless you face the trial that is before you. God knows the good that can come from the trial. We heard a great lesson about that. But I'd like us to look again at James chapter 1. James chapter 1. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials. Verse 3, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and let endurance have its perfect result, so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. I'm going to read just a little bit more in a moment, but I remember the first time I really studied James chapter 1. I was in the training program with LA, and I was going to go work my way through some of James. And I can't remember if he assigned me that or if I just took it upon myself, but looking there in chapter 1, you know how sometimes when you study something and then something clicks and you just remember that point, even if you remember nothing else that you studied, you still remember that point years later. Here's the point I remember from this. It says, you're going to come into trials. Those trials are going to give you the endurance that you need. That's what it can produce in you. And that can make you complete. You know what that says? God knows that we are incomplete without trials. Is God being mean-spirited? Is God this God who is inept and unable to deal with our struggle? No, here is a God who came down and faced the same struggle and allows His children to face the same struggle because He wants them perfected, just like His Son was perfected. And there's going to be a day when we cross the finish line and there's not going to be a struggle anymore. We will receive the crown and completion in Jesus Christ. Understand, we are complete in Christ right now, but that's kind of still a now but not yet situation, isn't it? We're looking for the ultimate completion. And God is saying, I'm getting you there every step of this course by letting you face these trials, by having you walk in the footsteps of my Son, so that you may learn from Him. We're going to come back to that idea of walking in the footsteps of Jesus. But I just want to note very quickly that the first person He says you can look to, even before He mentions looking to Jesus, is He says, you've got a great cloud of witnesses. When we think about this struggle, I think God wants us to think about the suffering saints of years before that we've just spent 3 days talking about. And that's why we need perseverant faith, endurant faith, so that we can get to perfected faith. Because these people were persecuted, and we're going to have to be persecuted if we're going to see the completion that comes in Jesus Christ. These witnesses, they are not merely spectators. In fact, some people have suggested, well, maybe they're just up in paradise watching us. Some have suggested that we need to take the legal sense of the word witness and say that their life gives testimony. I think it does give testimony to faith. But I like the way David McAllister described this. He said, they are like ex-players who are now coaching us as we go through the same struggles in which they once participated, telling us about the difficulties ahead of us, and thus preparing and encouraging us to endure them. There's great debate. You can go look at the literature if you're interested in looking at words. You already all know that I am a word nerd, and I bear that title. I don't want to say proudly, but I'm just going to bear that title. And yet, I do think it is significant when you start looking at the literature about the word for witness. Some people question whether or not it had this meaning in the first century, but it sure fits well that this is the word for martyr. And then isn't it interesting that when we come to another persecution text, that Jesus is a faithful martyr. And that you have other witnesses who have been beheaded for the cause of Christ. I don't know exactly when people started using the word martyr in Greek to describe the death of those who are faithful to a cause, but it sure fits these people in Hebrews chapter 11, especially at the end of chapter 11. He's saying, you look to this great cloud of martyrs. And they're going to tell you there's a struggle ahead, but they're also going to tell you faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not yet seen. There's a finish line. The struggle is not forever. You fight to the finish. You look to these people who have passed the baton and now are coaching us by their life how to finish the race. And then ultimately, you look to Jesus. That's the next major point I want us to consider is this author and perfecter of our faith. While it is important to look to this great cloud of witnesses, to realize that God's hand is in all of this as He sets this race, this course before us, I want us to know that God, from start to finish, is encouraging us Himself. That Jesus is the author and perfecter of faith. I like to illustrate it this way in the context of a race metaphor. That means Jesus was at the starting line, and He went before us, and now He's at the finish line, and we're running the same race that He had to run. Now the question is, are we going to fix our eyes on Him who is at the finish line beckoning His saints home? That's what Jesus wants to be for us. That's what He wants to do for us. In fact, this word translated author could be the idea of an originator. And that is definitely true. Jesus is the originator of faith, of faithfulness. He's the start of it. He's also the finisher of it. But in that sense, He is really the ultimate example of what it looks like to run the race of faith. Look with me in Hebrews chapter 2. This word translated author is used four times, if I remember correctly, in the New Testament. Two times in Acts, two times in Hebrews. Someone could correct me if I'm off on that. But I want us to look at the other occasion in Hebrews. In Hebrews chapter 2 and verse number 10. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse number 10 says, "For it was fitting for Him for whom are all things and through whom are all things, in bringing many sons to glory, to perfect the author of their salvation through sufferings." Did you notice how the author of the salvation of God's people was attained? Through sufferings. Does that sound familiar? Do you think this is just randomly repeated when we get to the exhortation in chapter 12 that our perfection is going to come through sufferings? Absolutely not. The author of our faith, the author of our salvation, is the one who, through sufferings, came to perfection. How are we going to come to perfection? How were all those who are going to join us in perfection, Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 40? How do they do that? Same way. Through faith, following the author of faith, and striving for the finisher of faith. That word perfecter, I think, is helpful because it does notice the connections between being perfected and the one who perfects. But I am still kind of partial to, I think it's the King James, maybe the New King James, it says finisher. Because that definitely helps us to see the race imagery as well, that He's finished. And boy, if we went through all the verses that talk about Jesus finishing something in the book of Hebrews, I think we would be here for quite a while. Jesus has finished. He could say, "It is finished." And now we are looking to Him as the finisher of faith. I'm going to quote one more time from David McAllister. Again, he has a lot of good thoughts in his Hebrews commentary. But here's one that stuck out to me. "Jesus stands as the capstone of the list of chapter 11. The people mentioned in chapter 11 only saw by faith the finish line and the reward for completion in the future ahead of them. But Jesus has actually crossed the finish line and has reached the heavenly goal itself. Do you remember what chapter 6 says in Hebrews? That there is a forerunner. That Jesus is the one who has gone beyond the veil. That's not the earthly tabernacle. It's the heavenly tabernacle. And so the forerunner is now leading all the other runners to the heavenly goal. What does perfection look like? Yes, I understand that this is a maturity, that we are pressing on to perfection. But what is perfection? But according to Revelation chapters 20 and 21, especially 21 and 22, but God's saints complete in His presence. Jesus has entered into rest. He's entered into the most holy place. He's crossed the finish line. He's the finisher. Why would you look to anyone else? This is how we're going to run this race, is looking away to Jesus. There's been a lot of ink spilled on what we're to look away from. Is it the cloud of witnesses? Is it the difficult, the hindrances, the sins that could entangle us? I think the New American Standard does a good job just saying, fix your eyes on Him. That takes care of whatever else we're supposed to look away from. We fix our eyes on Him. Why? Because He's the finisher. He's the one who has brought this to completion and wants to bring us to completion. Tell you what, we are, if we think we're already there, we've missed it. The best is yet to come. And it's crossing the finish line, and our Lord sharing His victory crown with His saints. It's worth it to run this race, to fight this struggle, to win against sin, because He is the author and perfecter of our faith. Here's why we respond as we do. Here's why we run. Here's why we look away from all else. It's because we want to focus on Jesus. And when we focus on Jesus, we hasten the finish line. Do we really hasten the finish line? Or do we get comfortable and lazy? Do we feel pretty good just in a gingerly pace? Are we wearing ourselves out in this race? And in the context of Hebrews, are we willing to let other people wear us out as we reach to the goal? It's going to be worth it someday. And we're going to be following in the example of Jesus, who Himself focused on God. If someone were to ask the question, how do I finish the race? How do I get to the finisher of faith? I think Hebrews has already answered that. He's given us very practical ways in which we can focus on Jesus in the same way that He focused on God. Look at chapter 5. Hebrews chapter 5. Hebrews chapter 5 and verse number 7. In the days of His flesh, He offered up both prayers and supplications with loud crying and tears to the one able to save Him from death. And He was heard because of His piety. Although He was a son, He learned obedience from the things which He suffered. And having been made perfect, He became to all those who obey Him the source of eternal salvation, being designated by God a high priest according to the order of Melchizedek. Do you see how Jesus was perfected? I'm not going to try to be simplistic, but I think there are some simple points here. He relied on God in prayer. He looked to God in worship. He learned from God in suffering. And if we walk the footsteps of Jesus, we will have that same epitaph for us, having been made perfect. We obey Jesus. We focus on Him, follow in His footsteps, and do as He did. We will be perfected. We will be brought to completion someday. But what's that look like? At each step of the way, what we've seen is through sufferings. Through sufferings. You see, the sobering thought of Hebrews chapters 12, 1 through 3 is that the King of Heaven gave up a crown to take a cross, to wear a crown. To change the metaphor a little bit, he took off the diadem and set it at the Father's feet. And then he allowed sinners to beat a crown of thorns into his head. So that in resurrection and ascension, he would take the crown and then all would throw their crowns at him. And then for those who walk his path, he gives them a crown. And you know what his people do in the book of Revelation? They're going to take that crown and they're going to cast it at his feet and say, it is all to him. He is the one who brought us here. He is the one who receives all glory and honor. This race, with its victory wreath at the end, is going to be a divine crown. The only way we're going to get there is by walking the path of Jesus. That means we're going to have to bear the cross in order to wear the crown. Look with me again in chapter 12 and verse number 2. Hebrews chapter 12 and verse number 2. Fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him. Let me just pause there for a second. Do you notice we have a race set before us and Jesus had joy set before him? What'd he do? He set aside that joy for a time. I know there's some debate here as to whether or not it's the joy that was before him versus, as in before the incarnation, the joy he was experiencing, or whether it's looking at the joy that lay up beyond the cross. I tend to think that in the context, we're future looking here each time, that just as the race is set before us, so the joy was also set before him. But what did he do with that joy? He used that as the motivation. It says, "Have the joy that was set before him endured the cross." I find it very significant that you don't find the word cross too often, especially in the book of Hebrews, but you find it here. This is a symbol of the shame. It says even that he was despising the shame. Again, this context of honor, shame, culture. What were they doing? They were saying, this so-called king is no king. This so-called Son of God deserves to be thrown into a ditch with the rest of the criminals. Says he looked past that. He didn't let the shame of the world stop him from serving the Lord because he saw something beyond that. Does that sound somewhat familiar to some of those people in the cloud of witnesses? Jesus is the ultimate representation of someone who went through struggle, went through a cross, and the shame that was associated with that. I don't have time to develop just how shameful the cross was in the first century. But he despised the shame and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. You hear what he's saying as you apply this? You're going to have to endure a cross in order to sit on a throne. We like to reverse that. We want to sit on a throne and avoid ever having to be on a cross. But Jesus shows us the only way to the cross, or excuse me, the only way to a crown is through a cross. Our life is crucified. But I think he's saying in a very real sense, are you willing to give up your body to crucifixion as well? I'm not dogmatic about to whom the audience is. But if it was Rome, it's not going to be too long before Nero is going to be stringing some Christians up. You're going to walk the steps of Jesus? You're going to take that cross the way he took the cross so that you can sit down with him? Look at verse number 3. For consider him who had endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. I do not find it insignificant that we have some themes that have been tracking all the way through the book of Hebrews, now centered in two verses. You look at Jesus in verses 2 and 3, and you have themes of faith, joy, endurance, and shame. Faith, joy, endurance, and shame. Track each of those concepts all the way through the book of Hebrews, and that tells me we have a very intricately built book that is meant to encourage Christians to endure. Why? Because they are going to be shamed by the world. But faith is going to see them to joy. That's how it worked for Jesus. That's how it's going to work for Jesus' followers. I'll tell you what, when the rubber hits the road, it's what am I willing to do to walk in the shadow of Jesus' cross? And it's not just the big sacrifices like Abel endured. It's the daily sacrifices like Enoch involved himself in. A cross for a crown. I've got a moment, so let me say this. I often have my wife read whatever I write, and she'll tell me that makes absolutely no sense. And she'll circle it, and I'll try to correct it. There was one section that I actually cut out a whole sentence or two, maybe three, because she said, I read it three times, and it didn't seem like it fit. And I was like, I know, I kind of felt that whenever I wrote it, but I really liked the point. So it didn't wind up in the workbook, but I'm going to say it now. There's an interesting wordplay that's happening here in Hebrews chapter 12, in verse number 3. When he says, consider him who endured such hostility by sinners against himself. The wordplay is that you have a form of the word logizome, which is consider, reckon. And so he says, consider him who endured such hostility. The word hostility is that root of logizome plus the word anti on the front. So, you consider him because they are anti-considering him. This shows us there are two choices here. You look at the shame of Jesus' cross. Are you going to consider him and walk the same path? Or are you going to see that as a shameful death and give him no consideration and in fact give him hostility? And then the question is, if you will consider him, are you willing to accept that same hostility? I don't want to ever bring up word points that are just academic, but I do think that's significant that he's saying, you've got two choices here. You either consider Jesus and bear his reproach, or you let that hostility against you by sinners cause you to lose heart. Make a choice. Who are you going to follow? Who are you going to be ashamed of? You're going to be ashamed of Jesus, or are you going to be ashamed of those who are trying to shame you? Don't let the shame of Jesus keep you from following him, because there is a crown at the end. Look with me in Revelation chapter 2. Revelation chapter 2. Revelation 2, verses 9 through 11. He says to the church in Smyrna, I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich. And the blasphemy of those who say that they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison so that you will be tested and you will have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. Who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. He who overcomes will not be hurt by the second death. Notice here. Obviously, both are inspired, but I don't know that John was necessarily referencing directly Hebrews chapter 12, but isn't it interesting the parallels you have for suffering saints? that the question is, do you really want this crown? Because if you really want this crown, you're going to bear the shame of Christ. You're going to be faithful, loyal to Him no matter what. And that's what's going to enable you to overcome the opposition. What does overcoming the opposition look like? It doesn't mean that you live a great life here. It looks like prison and it looks like death. But that is overcoming. Because in Jesus, He has shown us that if we die for Him, He will cause us to live again with Him. The resurrection. Death is not the end. Persecution is not worth giving up on Jesus. Resurrection, hope of glory. That's all going to make it worth it in the end. Consider and keep your eyes focused on Him. Speaking of the hope of glory, the weight of glory, I've read several books by C.S. Lewis. I haven't read them all, but one of my favorite collections is The Weight of Glory. And in fact, the sermon that he preaches, The Weight of Glory, is probably my favorite in that book. I'll maybe have some pushback on that later, but Weight of Glory is probably my favorite sermon in that. And I saved one of the quotes that we have from that book because it fits so well with Revelation 2, Hebrews chapter 12. It says, "The weight of glory provides the ultimate motivation for living a life of faith, pressing us to endure hardships and persevere in the face of adversity, knowing that our ultimate reward awaits us in eternity." Isn't that beautiful? The weight of glory. You compare that to Romans chapter 8, 1 Corinthians chapter 4, Hebrews chapter 12. Whatever burdens we bear here, whatever weight we have to bear here is nothing. Nothing in comparison to the glory that will be revealed in us. And so we use that motivation of, look what Jesus gained at the end. The glory that He had before the foundation of the world. And even though He will not share His glory with idols, He will let us participate in His glory in eternity. And He says, use that. When you're running and you get tired and you're worn out, stretch out to Jesus. And recognize glory is just at the edge of our fingertips. And really, this race is not too long. I become more and more aware that I'm getting older. I'm still in my 30s. But I think about the work that I can be involved in, and it becomes much more real that I only have so much more time to serve the Lord on this world. Glory is at the end. It's not going to be too long before this race is over. It may even be shorter if we do not succumb to the shame that the world is trying to place on us. But I tell you what, for these Christians, even if they strived against sin to the point of bloodshed, He's saying, that sacrifice is worth it because glory is at the end of the race. Faith will help us to persevere in the midst of trial. It will point us to those people of old, but will cause us to focus on Jesus Christ Himself. And when we finish this race, He'll give us the crown and we will cast it before His throne and say that He is worthy of all honor. Hebrews 11 is talking about the faith of our fathers. It's saying that's ultimately representative of Jesus who served the Father. Let us walk in His footsteps. There's one final thing I want to read before we close. I think it summarizes well what we've been studying. This is actually in the conclusion of the packet. I couldn't find this song in any of our hymnals, but as I was thinking through Hebrews chapter 11, I was looking for sources to kind of help me to understand this. And I read Robert Milligan's commentary at least this section on Hebrews. That goes, what, back to the 1800s? Is that when Robert Milligan wrote his commentary on Hebrews? But restore. And he had a line in quotation marks. It was one of the lines from this song. I didn't know it was a song. He didn't say, from so-and-so, or so-and-so said. He just put it in quotation marks, and I assumed, well, it's in poetic line, so I guess he's writing a poem to kind of summarize the point he's trying to make in Hebrews chapter 11. Come to find out, I started searching that line. I found this is part of a whole song. And so what was very familiar to them whenever he wrote has been lost to us. And yet, I found this song, and it's been put to various tunes. In fact, two tunes that I have found so far, and that would be the same tune that Christ for when you were baptized, however that title goes, and then Am I a Soldier of the Cross? But I want to read these lyrics because as we are determining whether or not we're going to follow Jesus and continue this race that our forefathers in the faith have started, the question is, will we walk the path that they walked? This song is called Rise, O My Soul, Pursue the Path. John Needham in 1768 wrote, Rise, O my soul, pursue the path by ancient heroes trod. Ambitious view those holy men who lived and walked with God. Though dead, they speak in reason's ear and in example live. Their faith and hope and mighty deeds still fresh instruction give. Say, by whose strength their feeble flesh such various toil sustained. Say, by what means their heirs, these heirs of grace immortal triumphs gained. 'Twas through the Lamb's most precious blood they conquered every foe, and to His power and matchless grace their crowns and honors owe. Warmed by the love that stirred their breasts, we shall be heroes too. Inspired by equal faith and zeal, what wonders we shall do. The world and flesh shall be denied, nor shall we dread the cross. Please that our future gains increase by every present loss. Lord, may I ever keep in view the patterns Thou hast give, and ne'er forsake the blessed road that led them safe to heaven. John Needham had a good idea of what Romans 12, 1 through 3 was talking about in Hebrews chapter 11. And if we want to bring that back into our hymnals, I'd be just fine with that. We could do to the tune of Am I a Soldier of the Cross, or maybe someone who knows music might be able to write some new music for us. But we need to rise up and pursue this path. This is not just an interesting historical exercise to look at the people of old. These are the people who are saying, keep on running. Don't give up. And we can fix our eyes on the one who loved us and gave himself for us as he holds his arms out to us at the finish line and says, keep going. Perfection is at the end of this race, and a crown I will bestow on you. Thank you all for your attention.